Welcome to a special edition of the Marketplace Roundtable podcast featuring Jay Mintzmyer of Value Investor's Edge. Jay first began contributing to Seeking Alpha in 2011, building up a large following through his work covering shipping stocks, probably about as comprehensively as they're covered anywhere online or in print. Since 2015, Jay has run the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. The service offers intensive coverage of deep value opportunities in the shipping, energy, MLP, and industrial sectors. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's Mintzmyer, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. And now your host, Jay Mintzmyer.
Good morning, everyone. Good afternoon if you're joining us from Europe. We're hosting another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live. Today, we're hosting Grindrod Shipping, stock symbol GRIN, and their CEO, Martin Wade, and CFO, Stephen Griffiths. Grindrod specializes in the small to medium-sized dry bulk segment. They had an IPO around 2 years ago, and initially they had a mixed fleet of product tankers and dry bulk, but now they've simplified a lot more and focused more specifically on that small and medium-sized dry bulk market. With the small and mid-sized market prospects rapidly improving, it's time to follow up with Grindrod and see if they can share with us some insights on this key segment of the market. They've also had a lot of corporate changes, a lot of simplification, and we'll talk through that a little bit. So with that said, welcome, Martin, and welcome, Steve, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much. Our pleasure.
Pleasure, Jay.
Absolutely. Just before we get into the formal questions, a reminder that nothing on the call today constitutes investment advice in any form or fashion or official company guidance from Grindrod. I have no current stock position in Grindrod. Keep in mind, we're recording on the morning of 4 March 2021, about 8 a.m. So if you're listening to this recording at a later date, please make sure you look up the latest disclosures. So again, welcome. As I said in the intro, you know, Grindrod had that mixed fleet of bulkers and tankers, but you've clearly been divesting a lot of tankers. I think you only have four left. Is that correct? And what is your core focus going forward? Is it indeed those small and mid-sized bulkers, or is it a little bit more broad?
Thanks, Jay. No, very, very much. So the Handy and Supermax, Ultramax bulkers. Yes, as you correctly say, we've got four tankers left. One, which is on a long-term charter in New Zealand under the New Zealand flag, which constitutes an investment these days. It's a charter we've had with the previous ship now for 15-odd years. Of our other three tankers, two MRs and a small 16,500-tonner, they are on the market for sale and being actively worked as we talk. So we will be exiting the tanker space, by the look of it, hopefully in the next, probably Q2, maybe into Q3. And that's, we very much want to concentrate on the dry side. The original premise for tankers was always you buy the ships, put them on long-term charter. We had specific clients in South Africa, 10 years, you pay them off, make a nice profit, and then you can sell them on the market. That model has obviously disappeared with the advent of the three major traders and all companies using their older existing ships. So they say we're getting out of tankers, concentrate on the Handys and Supers, Ultras. And we've been an operator of cargo for 45 years. We still have some of our original contracts on an evergreen basis, which means they get renewed every year, which forms the core base. And from that, we've developed into full-on first through chartering long-term ships from the Japanese with purchase options and then into actually ordering our own fleet from Japan. So that's where our speciality is. The core business, a lot of it is in the Indian Ocean where we say we've been 45 years. And as for going into other sizes, I've always been a believer that, you know, you don't want to be a jack of all trade, master of none. Let's stick to where we know, what we understand, where to a degree we have a major position in that market and we understand it.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear you say that you're specializing and you're focusing. I know I've watched Grinrod from a distance since your initial public offering, and you know the mixed fleet. It was interesting at times. I think maybe last summer is a little bit more exciting with that little tanker floating storage trade we had. Right, it was a bright flash in the pan, if you will. But I do like the fact that you're focusing a little bit more, and particularly, again, we're recording for March here. One of the reasons I wanted to bring you on and talk to you today is the small bulkers rates are surging, and the Supermax rates are surging. And you know, so you have Supermax rates that are higher than Panamax rates. I've seen them higher than Capes because I know there's a lot of seasonality, but I don't think I've ever seen Handymax rates stronger than Panamax rates. So that's quite interesting. Can you talk a little bit about what's driving that market? What factors are there? And is this a short-term phenomenon or is this a longer-term change in the market?
Well, as usual with shipping, I've been in the business 43 years, and you can never quite predict the future. Last year was looking rather good until January came along in the pandemic. But I think that this time around things are different. First off, we have a very low order book going forward for the first time in a very long time, which is fantastic, in over 10 years now. And then if you look at what happened in the world basically stopped in Q2 last year. Everyone in lockdown, no trade going on. And we then took the view at that point that the world has to recover. And we were actually quite active at the time in taking ships on period charter for 1 year, option 1 year from our Japanese friends. And then you overlay that with the massive biblical, as they were calling it, floods in China, where there were serious questions raised about the Three Gorges Dam, whether it would actually survive. The water got so high and so strong, which basically wiped out the Chinese grain crops. And at that point, we suddenly saw in the market starting in July, they were making massive purchases of US grain. Now, a lot of people said it was all under the trade agreement with Trump, etc. Nothing to do with that. The volume they were buying at was rivaling the Russians after Chernobyl, and it got bigger and bigger. So that was all very positive. So we knew that from the Handys up to the Kamsarmaxes, this would be very, very good. And then when they got into this trade dispute with the Chinese and Australia, refusing to take Australian coal, we kind of thought, now that really is interesting because China needs the coal. This winter there's been La Nina as opposed to El Nino, and La Nina always brings brutally cold winters in the Northern Hemisphere, which again you had in the States a little while ago, that has been through Europe, but in particular China and Korea, and it's left these countries short on energy, not enough LNG, so it resorts to coal. Now, with China not buying from Australia, they were buying from everywhere else. Yes, Indonesia, but Indonesia couldn't make up that shortfall. So they've been buying from America, Colombia, the Black Sea, so serious tons, sea miles. At the same time, Australian coal, of course, became the cheapest in the world because the Chinese didn't want it. So the Australians have developed new markets, predominantly India. So that's further ton sea miles. And of course, South Africa normally supplies coal to India. So they've been forced to sell their coal to China, increasing the ton sea miles. And of course, now with the cold winter, that Australia is, for the first time in a long time, exporting coal to Europe. So the whole thing is kind of almost built into this, not perfect storm, but a very interesting storm. And then you add in that the problems with all the crew changes, the inefficiencies with ships. So you go to Australia, you can't have any crewmen on board longer than 10, 11 months. You have to change. So only certain ships can. And then with other ships, and a two-week quarantine going into China. And you've had some massive inefficiencies built into the market, which has actually exposed that supply-demand balance, finally, is a lot closer than people think. And the order book is just diminishing. I mean, January was the lowest deliveries, I think, for 10 years. So it's a lot of positive news in shipping. And countries, you know, especially in the West, are you going to pay people $1,200 or $1,400 a month to sit on a sofa, or are you going to get involved with infrastructure? And that seems to be very much, China started it very early. Europe seems to be the same. And Biden talking about it, which would be fantastic, but you actually look at how much steel is suddenly going from Asia into America in Ultramax, our sizes, serious long-haul business, 60, 70-day voyages. So there seems to be something afoot at the moment, which is all building into very, very positive rates. And yeah, I mean, we've got Handys earning 16,000-17,000, Ultras earning, well, Ultras, you just ask, what's the rate? And you just tell everyone, I don't know, 20,000-25,000, wherever they want to go. I mean, it is staggering how tight it is and how much business is out there. So exciting times.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been following dry bulk for 12 years, and there haven't been a lot of exciting times in dry bulk in the last 12 years. I mean, the 2010s were a lost, dead, miserable decade, if you will. So, you know, it's good to see that we're sort of turning that corner. Hopefully there's more legs to it. As you mentioned, 2020 was looking pretty good in most of the segments until COVID hit. So hopefully this is we're resuming that cycle. You know, the supply is, as you mentioned, very low. Demand's picking back up. What about environmental regulations? I know that's mostly a focus on some of the larger classes, the Capesizes, Newcastlemaxes, and such. But what sort of environmental regulation challenges do you have? I know there's some talk about carbon emission caps and such in 2023. Does that apply to your handy size or midsize segments at all?
Well, we've always been advocates, always, you know, deliberately had a very modern Japanese-built fleet. So eco, ticking all the green boxes, that more regulation is required. We've always been a very dirty business, and the ability to trade ships, yes, slightly different these days than the old days of 25, 30 years, but that is now changing. And if you look at the reason that CO2 emissions have dropped by, is it 40-odd percent since 2008? Of course, it's been slow steaming, but that's been forced upon owners by the market, because when things got bad, everyone slows down. Now, what shipping the industry has to do is maintain that those slower speeds. So when you look at 2023 with the energy index coming out, and the initial, I was reading something this afternoon, suggesting that any ship built before 2013, i.e. non-eco, you know, that's 2013 was the first generation, basically has a problem, and they're going to have to slow down incredibly or retrofit, which you can't really do. So this regulation feeding in, and that goes to the order book going forward. What on earth do you order? I mean, it's all still heavy fuel oil burning engines. It might be low sulfur, it's still heavy fuel oil, the same as it has been for decades. And you're going to be a brave man to go and order in the East and for a view with a ship that you want for 20 years, and it could well be made redundant in 10. So yes, there are some attractive deals out there, but I don't think anyone can afford to go near it because of the lack of finance and the way this green lobby, which is fantastic, is being taken seriously. And ESG, absolutely top of our criteria these days. You really got to be looking forward, all our banks asking. And of course, with the fleet we've got, where well over two thirds of it is built 2014 onwards, we would like to think we're pretty well placed for that. And of the older ones, we've got one 14-year-old ship. All the rest are built 2010, 11, 12, predominantly Japan. And we will have to look at that. But again, you're going into a firm market now. Secondhand prices are rising. Could be 15, 20% up in Q1, Q2 this year. It'll give us the option of maybe selling out those older ships, and we can come to the joint venture later, reinvesting it in more modern ships.
Yeah, it sounds like from your perspective, at least with the, you know, two thirds of your fleet being eco or at least more modern, you know, the environmental challenges, if anything, could be a tailwind, could be a positive, which is, you know, that's not the same for all ship owners. I have a slide that I've been looking at of your fleet, and I'll make sure I post it later with the recording, but, you know, breaks down the ships and by the age and such. It looks like you have about seven ships in the handy size pool that are built between 2007 and 2012, as it were. So perhaps those might be divestment candidates in the future. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. And we've average age of the fleet is 6 years, but we do have those six, seven older ships, and you know, which we will look to divest. But you know, with current regulations, of course, we can trade them. And when you have 14-year-old ships earning $16,000-$17,000 a day, it's yes, we will look to sell them as the market increases and what we have to do, but they're quite nice cash cows at the moment after an awful long wait.
Yeah, it seems like there's not as much of a difference now in the current rates, but perhaps in 23 or going forward, there could be a difference. You know, in some of the larger segments, we're looking at LNG fueled, you know, dual fuel ships, but it seems like in the smaller vessels, the cost to either retrofit or install such an engine, or even with a new build, would be astronomical. So I don't know if that's something that's been considered yet for something like a Supermax or an Ultramax, but you know, I know we've seen the Newcastles. Has there been any talk about alternative fuels for the midsize and smaller vessels yet, or is it mostly just emission standards?
To do alternative fuels on the small ones, because of course it's the smaller ones, we're the minor bulk, so we're tramping all over the world, multiple ports, countries. It makes sense on the bigger capes, because of course you're basically trading Tuba Rail China, West Australia China, invariably passing Singapore, so you'll always be able to get your LNG there. But for a bulker, you know, if we're trading Indian Ocean and South America and South Africa, you've got to have freely available fuel. So I think that's a long way to go. I heard, you know, I was on a panel the other day with John Woburn Smith, and they were talking about exploring ammonia, which is quite an exciting fuel, albeit don't let it get anywhere near the crew, you'll kill them. So there's certain issues there. But then you wonder, is it going to be hydrogen, the holy grail? And you know, I haven't been to Japan now, sadly, for about over 12 months. The last time I was there, we used to go regularly. They were reckoning that hydrogen might be 15 years away. Excuse me. They now talk about maybe less than 10. So, and I think as an owner, what we're going to have to do is, because remember, the last 10 years have been disaster, that, you know, owners don't really have cash, is that you play a watch and wait attitude, whereby you don't want to be the first owner into anything new, especially in our segment, because you might be a trailblazer, or there's a very good chance you might be wrong. So let's picture it as a wait and see. And a decent market will then afford yards the chances to maybe explore new designs, new propulsion types. And as owners, maybe we'll have the cash to invest in it as well. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg here.
Yeah, certainly makes sense. You know, hopefully you'll have the earnings and cash flow up front, which will enable you to, you know, finance those things if they're required. You know, hydrogen's been quote unquote 10 to 15 years away since like 2001. So hopefully hopefully we're getting a little closer, but you know, it's always been, you know, just around the next corner, and it seems like we're still kind of there in terms of shipping fuels. Probably closer, but still quite far away. Let's pivot a little bit and talk about your commercial operations. So you have basically two different classes. You have the handy size vessels, the smaller bulkers, and you have the medium size, the Supermax and Ultramaxes. Those are both in pools, commercial pools. Can you talk a little bit about that? Are those basically all spot, or is there any sort of charter coverage on those?
Yeah, we run the two pools. On the handies, we actually have outside owners from Japan. We've got three or four at the moment who put their ships with us. And that is a pure spot pool. Very little cargo coverage, purely because the last few years the cargo coverage contracts on offer have been, you know, sub break even, in fact sub OPEX some of them. It's a shocker. So we deliberately took the decision not to take any long term contracts, rather rely on the market. We do outperform. It's been tough, but now we're going into this market now with our handies, with basically no cover. And it's fantastic because, of course, every fixture we're just getting whatever the market rate on the day is. Our Super Ultramax operation is slightly different because of having morphed from a full cargo operator in South Africa. So with our parcel services there running to the continent, Mediterranean, times to the east and the States, we've always had legacy cargo. So we've developed that, and then we have other areas. We have big contracts into Madagascar with Japanese friends and Korean friends, and we also do a lot of the coal, or do all the coal into Mauritius, Reunion, just about. So that is our backyard, and that is very much Supermax, Ultramax. So what we tend to do is we operate around that. So in the bad times, we've always been able to keep a percentage of our ships away from the market, trading in own business. Now, as the times get better, a lot of our contracts are index linked, so they're linked to the market. So the market goes up, the freight rates go up, and we then operate around them, positioning them, arbitraging. Do we use our own ships, other people's ships? So on that segment, we've probably got some in the region of, Stephen probably, 25-30% cover. So still very, very long to the market. But, you know, when you've had relationships, contracts, 40, 45 years, you just don't walk away. And the nature of our contracts, it tends to be high-value commodities with absolutely blue-chip names and commodities that get shipped irrespective of what's going on in the world. So even in Q2 last year, you still had certain commodities is running because you get these massive plants that they can't just stop the plant. If you switch a specialized steel plant or nickel ore plant off, you'd be very difficult to reopen it. So we've always targeted high-quality people who will pay a small premium for the right counterparty. So we've always been that. We haven't been kind of boots and all, let's go and book everything and give it a go. We've always been aiming for trades where the barriers to entry are that little bit higher.
Yeah, I think that's helpful. Because as investors or speculators, you know, we look at the market and we see the spot rates and we see the last few months of rates. And, you know, we kind of want to be able to know, you know, what sort of exposure Grindrod has. And it sounds like, you know, the current spot rate is a very good indicator for the handy size market and as well for the midsize. But I think you mentioned about 30% of kind of rolling charter cover and maybe closer to 70% spot. So it sounds like on either side, you have a lot of exposure to the spot rates. But just important to know that, you know, especially when you're an investor's picking right between different dry bulk companies, knowing which ones actually have the spot exposure can be helpful. I know there's been times when, you know, you see the rate surging and then the quarterly result comes out and, you know, there's really no benefit. So hopefully that won't be the case. Let's pivot a little bit to some financial and capital allocation questions and hopefully give Steve some chance to talk a little bit here. There's been a lot of joint venture changes at Grindrod. I remember right when you IPO'd, there was, I think it was like four or five different joint ventures, but that has simplified. So can we talk a little bit about those initiatives?
Yes, Joe. Steve, yeah, I'll take that. So just a bit of background, yeah, since the listing in June 2018, you know, one of our main strategic initiatives has been to eliminate the 19 vessels housed in off-balance sheet joint ventures. So the increase in our shareholding of RVS Bulk to 67% in February gave us control of the JV and the ability to consolidate the results of the JV, as opposed to previously where we accounted for them under equity accounting method. So as a reminder, this JV is the one that owns 12 Japanese-built eco vessels, six of which are handy-sized bulk carriers and six of which are Supramax bulk carriers. So this consolidation gives us balance sheet scale, it improves our EBITDA figures, and for the investor, allows for an easier understanding of our structure. In addition to those, we had four vessels in the Leopard Tanker JV. Those were distributed to two shareholders, leaving us with 200% owned tankers. The remaining three, so as I say, we had 19, I've discussed the 12 and the four. The remaining three vessels were sold directly out of the JVs, the last being sold in November, with the result that we no longer have any vessels housed in off-balance sheet joint ventures. So strategic initiative done.
Good to see that simplification. I know when you first IPO'd, I mentioned how the, you know, mixed fleet was kind of challenging, and you know the joint ventures also kind of obscured. I think there's a lot of value in the joint ventures, but the way they were not consolidated on the balance sheet kind of obscured a lot of the value there. Your IVS bulk venture, is there any way to bring that fully owned, or are those partners going to be long term there?
At the moment, it's about 9%. Great partners, and they've been with us 7 years. At the end of the day, we've gone through the really tough times. We have a great relationship with them. As far as we understand, that they're happy being in. Obviously, values are rising, so we will see what happens going forward. But it's a great working relationship. And our last conversation, I think we agree we'd love to share the spoils of this market and go forward. At some point, yes, they could well come and talk to us, and we will assess at the time. As I said, we have a number of, as you point out, seven older ships which will be looking to sell, which will raise quite a lot of cash, and we will take a view at the time. So it will all be dependent on the market. If they're happy to stay in, we're very happy to have them. And again, the classic thing, I don't want to get too excited about this market, the classic thing is that when things, you know, really do start to move, as it looks like, you don't want to get carried away towards the top. So it's always the balance, and buying and selling ships is always a part of any rising market where you've got to take money off the table. So we will look at that nearer the time, but at the moment, as I say, it's working very well, great relationship, and let's see where it takes us for the rest of this year into next.
I think that's reasonable. I think the consolidation of the assets onto the balance sheet and with the way you report earnings will make things a lot more straightforward. We talked about with rates improving into 2021, you're going to have a lot more cash flow available. So with that additional cash flow available, what's going to be the primary focus for capital allocation? And is there a target leverage range? If so, are you already there?
Yeah, Jay, Steve, yeah, I'll take that one. So yes, we will be using cash generated from the current strong dry bulk market, first off, to reduce debt and to strengthen our balance sheet further. The MES debt is our first target, which will be paid down, cleared by a combination of the proceeds of the sales of those three tankers, which Martin referred to, that are on the market, and as mentioned earlier, from the cash generated from our current strong spot market earnings. So following that, we'll likely look to a combination of further debt repayment and cash retention in order to improve our liquidity and balance sheet flexibility in case markets take an unexpected downturn. So your question on regards to targeted leverage, based on December valuations, our average bank debt on the vessels was a touch under 60%. So in 2020, the interest expense and debt repayment, that amounted to just over 4,000 per day, which was roughly 40% of our own dry bulk fleet break-even cost per day. So a reduction of $1,000 per day there, or say a reduction from 60% to a 45% loan to value based on December valuations, which is certainly a minimum target, would improve our cash position by $8 million a year based on our current fleet.
Yeah, certainly certainly something to watch, but the leverage sounds reasonable, a little bit on the high end in terms of direct to vessels. So it sounds like a little bit of deleveraging might be in the cards for 2021. Are there any official dividend plans or policies?
No, Joe, Steve, again, I'll take that. Yeah, so following on from what I mentioned on the earlier question with regards to strengthening our balance sheet, thereafter with no planned CapEx, we look to start paying a dividend as we move further into the cycle. And, I guess if for whatever reason our share price doesn't react to these higher earnings, we would then consider further share repurchases to what we did at the end of 2019, where we bought back 300,000 shares.
Yeah, share repurchases are always interesting when the company trades at a large discount to NAV. There's definitely some share acquisition there.
The secret is if you look at S&P brokers, the big boys, their valuations, and we get values every quarter. Every quarter last year, they went down, which was kind of understood at the beginning, but we've been scratching our heads how 31 December valuations could be, to be honest, fairly substantially lower than 30 June valuations when the market had changed out of all proportion. So now as we're heading, obviously now, and we can see from the S&P market, it's been the most active in 10 years. A lot of Greek buyers are out there, every ship's being inspected, and a lot of owners are pulling their ships from the market, which is interesting, decided they don't want to sell them after all. So we're anticipating conservatively 10 to 15% up on Q1, and this will move forward because you can't have low handy size values where the ships are earning $16,000, $17,000 a day. I mean, otherwise we'd all be ship owners. So that we a gap on NAV, it's going to be closing, there's no doubting, but the predominant way that happens, of course, is through the value of the fleet rising and obviously cash generation and what we do with it thereafter.
Yeah, let's hope for the best cash generation, but ideally if your discount range does not close, I definitely agree that repurchases make sense here. I know you did some in the past. And of course, it'll always depend on, how good the market is, where your liquidity is at, what your leverage looks like, and so on. One of the points I've kind of pushed you on a little bit since IPO is that Grindrod does semi-annual reporting. And I know that's all you really have to. In fact, foreign listed firms really only have to do their annual filings. But is there any plans to change to a quarterly?
Yes, Jay. Yep. Look, we understand that quarterly reporting is the norm in the US, and we are committed to going the quarterly reporting route. We are, however, working through some technical issues, that we're hoping to resolve in time for Q1 reporting. So, we will keep the investor market abreast of those developments.
So if I heard you correctly, Steve, it sounds like the ideal plan is to do a quarterly report for Q1 of 21, but not 100% committed to that yet. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So we committed to quarterly reporting, it's a case of whether we can get there for Q1.
Certainly makes sense, Steve. And of course, I saw your forward fixture guidance in the Q4 report, and it sounds like, you know, of course, you fixed some of that spot coverage, you know, in probably the end of November into December. So it seems like Q2 is going to really be the strong quarter in terms of big cash flows. Q1's going to be decent, but Q2 is really going to be the banger. So it would be nice to be able to split those up in the quarterly reports. I think sometimes some of that gets lost in the semi-annual, or, you know, let's be honest, if we have to wait for a semi-annual report, we might not see H1 21 results until what, like August or September. So quarterly format, I think there'll be a lot more investor interest. So that's my advocacy piece for today.
Yeah, thanks, Jay. And we understand that. And you know, absolutely. If you go the problem is, if you go for the 6 monthly reporting, you can't divvy it up into the two quarters. So we understand that, and that's why we've seen what we can do if we can work through these technical issues. But having said that, if it doesn't happen now, you know, we committed to getting to quarterly reporting to be in line with all of our peers.
Yeah, thank you, Steve, and we'll keep in touch, and hopefully look forward to seeing those Q1 results. And really fascinating turn in the market. Hopefully, it's got some legs. You know, battle scarred, right, from the 2010s, where every little upturn was like a false start. And I think other investors feel the same way. And it would be nice to see a little bit more follow through, like we saw in the early 2000s, right? There was multi-year follow through. So hopefully that'll be the case. But you know, you never know in shipping. So as kind of a closing question, a chance for you, Martin, and also Steve, if you want to pitch in at all, why should investors consider Grenrod as opposed to peers? Look, I mean, there's a lot of dry bulk companies out there. There's like 11, right? So why should an investor focus on Grenrod? What do you offer that's different, and what are your core focuses?
Well, obviously, we're specialized. So it is the Handys, Supras, Ultras. When the Capes join this party, as they will at some point, and obviously if Cape rate starts screaming 40, 50, 60,000, everyone's going to be looking at them, which will be exciting, which will be great for sentiment. For us, I say we're pretty specialised. We have a high quality fleet. And one thing you must remember about the S&P market is that 90% of the buyers, 85% of the buyers are Greek. And they all want one thing. They basically want Japanese-built ships because that's what they understand, the reliability. So you will always see in any market that there's a disconnect of about 30-35% between Japanese secondhand and Chinese secondhand. And this will increase it in a decent market. Yes, the adage that all boats will be floated on a good tide, but We have a lot of value in our fleet if we then choose to start playing the S&P market. We also have genuine outperformance. We don't do kind of in-house tailored indices. We report against the Baltic 58 index, and our performance is against that. So the outperformance we've historically done of some 20-25%, that's all genuine. So we are there, high quality. We have the backup of a percentage of cargo we've always had. So We will get through it. So yeah, a lot of great names. We're looking again, investors kind of for the long haul. Maybe it would be lovely to be in a position, but again, we need a bigger market cap, kind of long only, taking a longer view on us. And as I say, with no capex, as Steve said, going forward, once we've sorted out, you know, deleveraged a bit, it goes straight to the bottom line and become dividend paying at a certain level. And I think the question is, why wouldn't you buy our shares?
Why would you not? All right, Martin. Well, I haven't bought any yet, so maybe I need to.
That one.
I need to get to work. Maybe I missed the train there. But no, anyways, Martin and Steve, thank you both for joining us today. I think it was useful, especially with talking about the small size bulker market, because that's a market segment that usually doesn't get a lot of attention. And right now, it's basically the most exciting segment of dry bulk. So thanks again for joining.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you, Trey. Appreciate it.
Pleasure, Jay.
This includes another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live. We just finished hosting Grenrod Shipping, hosting the CEO, Martin Wade, and CFO, Steve Griffiths. Grenrod Shipping is a dry bulk focused firm focused on the smaller and mid-sized dry bulk assets. As a reminder, nothing on a call today constitutes investment advice or company guidance in any form or fashion. I have no current position in Grenrod Shipping, stock symbol GRIN. This was recorded on 4 March 2021 at about 8 a.m. Eastern Time. If you've been enjoying the Seeking Alpha Marketplace Roundtable podcast, you can subscribe through iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Stitcher. You can also give reviews on those platforms to help other investors discover this podcast. Jay Mintzmyer runs the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's Mintzmyer, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site, or by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for Value Investor's Edge there.